Okay, so this is work done in collaboration with Eugenio Bianchi, who used to be a postdoc here at PI and is now in Penn State. And it's reported in a couple of recent papers. There's another one that should be out really and will be soon, hopefully. Okay, and the physical problem is the one of gravitational collapse in general relativity. As a matter of distribution, distribution of matter collapses under its own weight. Classical general relativity predicts that it will eventually form a singularity hidden behind an event horizon. And in the process, the matter distribution will couple to the metric, which itself will couple to any quantum field in this spacetime phi. And in particular, in the early stages of this evaporation process, a flux of energy is recorded at future null infinity, scry plus. And that flux was computed by Hawking to have a temperature given by 1 over 8 pi times the mass of this incipient black hole. The problem I'm addressing today is what happens next at the end of this process. So this is true for some time. But then eventually, of course, all the mass that's dragged from the black hole to infinity reduces the size and the mass of the black hole. And the question is, what happens next? So this is the question that the physical problem that I want to try and address today. The perhaps most standard approach to this problem is try and compute gravitational back reaction order by including the energy momentum tensor of the field into the metric using the Einstein equations, and then compute again the energy momentum of the field given that corrected metric, and then again and then again. So this is a recursive procedure whereby one computes order by order in H bar corrections to the background classical metric. But the approach here that I'll take today is slightly different. The approach will be to forget a bit about the bulk of spacetime and try and put constraints on what can actually happen at scry plus, meaning for, say, static observers that are very far from the black hole at very light times. So to a first approximation, what is seen there is an outgoing energy flux with this temperature. And we want to understand what happens dynamically in this process here. So the main message I'm trying to convey now is, let's focus on scry plus asymptotically rather than on the bulk and its corrections. OK. Given this perspective, we can use tools to understand what might happen at the late stages of the evaporation of a black hole. And one of them is entanglement entropy. Entanglement entropy is one observable for a quantum field. It's not more beautiful or more interesting than other observables. In particular, the flux and the temperature are also good observables. But it just so happens that it's quite enlightening in terms of problems related to the loss of information in a black hole. So focusing on the entanglement entropy of the field will help us get some understanding, I believe, of the picture. So in the first section of the talk, I'll tell you about how to compute entanglement entropy in a two-dimensional approximation that I'll describe. In the next section, I'll explain how entanglement entropy is actually related to the energy flux that's perceived at scry plus. And I will show the following proposition, if you wish, which is, if evaporation is unitary, a statement that I'll make more precise later on, then the retarded mass of the black hole as perceived at retarded time u at scry plus cannot be monotonically decreasing. So this is, of course, in contrast with what happens in classical general relativity, where the positive energy conditions make sure that this so-called Bondi mass is a decreasing function of retarded time. But of course, a quantum field violates energy conditions, and so one can expect that something might change, and indeed, it must change. So this is the first result that I want to tell you about today in section two. And in section three, I'll prove another proposition regarding the late stages of a black hole evaporating. No. So it's the mass of the object in the bulk that is being measured by the Mondi mass. Okay, so that object loses energy to infinity. So the mass of the object that remains, which is the ADM mass minus whatever was radiated, that one decreases. The total energy of that system plus energy that comes out of space-time is conserved. Yeah? Okay. Okay. The second proposition will be about timescales in this process. I can't tell you exactly what happens in the process, but I can tell you this. Again, if evaporation is unitary, then the last stages of the evaporation, which is a phase of purification of the field, will be slow. It will be very slow. It cannot be explosive. And again, I'll make this statement precise in the talk, later in the talk. So the program for the talk is to understand and prove these two statements here. So let's start with section one, entanglement entropy. So entanglement entropy, quick reminder is, given a quantum system that is bipartite, so it has two subsystems A and B, any state for the combined system leads to reduced states raw A and raw B for the subsystems by partial tracing. The entanglement entropy of A and B is formally given by the Feynman entropy of these reduced states, and it is symmetric in AB. Physically, what this quantity measures is the intensity of quantum correlations between the two systems, quantum coherencies between the two subsystems. It's not a measure of A, it's not a measure of B, it's a measure of what goes on in the middle between A and B, at the interface between A and B. And that's how it's actually symmetric in exchanging A and B. The trace of this operator here. Okay, raw B is the trace over A of psi. Raw A is the trace over B of psi. And the entanglement entropy of A and B is the trace of that operator. Oh. Sorry about that. Trace over A of this, trace over, okay, I was being too quick. Sorry about that. I just said it's formally given by this expression, and I meant two things by this. The first thing is we don't know in general how to compute this quantity. And second, it is plagued anyway by ultraviolet divergences in a quantum field theory. In a quantum field theory, there are modes that are very, very short scale, arbitrarily short scale, and they contribute to the entanglement entropy in a divergent way. So the two issues that one faces are these. First of all, try and find a computational way to get access to this quantity. And second, regularize it. So in two dimensions, for two-dimensional field theories, this problem was, both problems were essentially solved by Holsey, Larsen, and Wilczek in a famous paper of, I believe, 94. And the result is this. In a two-dimensional space-time, say flat space for the moment, Tx, given a Cauchy slice at constant T, sigma, and given a subsystem A that corresponds to a segment in that slice, and B is the rest, B is the complement of A, the entanglement entropy of A and B is given by C over 12, I'll explain in a second what C is, delta U squared, delta V squared over epsilon to the 4. In this formula here, epsilon is an ultraviolet cutoff that we need to make this quantity finite. C is the central charge if the field theory I'm looking at is a conformal field theory, okay? And U and V are retarded time and advanced time, respectively. Delta U delta V corresponds to U of one boundary point of the segment minus U of the other boundary point, similarly for V. So this you can think of as being measuring the length, the proper length, if you wish, of the segment A. So this formula is excellent in flat space, but it has an issue when you want to extend it to curved space times, and that is basically that epsilon, you're not sure how to make sense of. This is a length scale, okay, which is therefore not Lorentz invariant, and in a curved space time, it's not clear how you would pick a frame to define this epsilon here. This isn't. Yeah. You might expect that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's not Lorentz invariant in flat space either, but it's even more difficult in curved spaces because from one region to the next, you can't even have a global frame. So you could imagine in flat space that you would fix one global frame and make sense of this in that frame. Yeah. Absolutely. It's a ultraviolet cutoff. It's a small length scale. It's a length scale. It's a small length scale. By hand. Yeah. In some frame. Yeah. Yeah. So that's excellent if you do. Yeah, so I'm just about to improve this formula now. So this is how it's given in this old paper, and I just want to say how we can move from there to something that's more Lorentz invariant and makes more sense also in curved space times. So this is just a starting point here, okay? There. Very good. So so this is an excellent formula for condensed matter theory where the cutoff and the frame are clearly defined. It's the proper frame of the matter that you're looking at, and epsilon might be the lattice spacing. But for a quantum field theory in a curved spacetime, this formula is good, but not good enough. This is what I was just about to say. So the goal now is to make sense of this formula. Not reinvented, but just make sense of it in curved spacetimes. Okay. So,
can you give your opinion on why this is correct formula? It looks like it's just the log of the propagator.
No, I'm not going to give that. It's another talk.
Okay. What's the. There's no way to understand that formula. Yes.
I'm taking this as a result for the purpose of this talk. Okay, so the setting I'm interested in for the moment, let's say, is a two-dimensional space-time that is meant to represent a spherically symmetric 3+1-dimensional space-time in the time radius section. And that has the conformal structure of Minkowski space, let's say, but it's not flat. Okay, so being conformal to Minkowski, it has past null infinity and future null infinity. It has spatial infinity. And this here, you should think of as the boundary r equals naught in the spherically symmetric spacetime that this is meant to represent. how are we going to make sense of the entanglement entropy of a massless field, of a conformal field, given a separation of a Cauchy slice between A and its complement? The first thing we'll do is listen carefully to what Raphael has to say, and that is realize that a different Cauchy slice that goes through the same boundary points should lead to the same entanglement entropy. And so in other words, the first step is to realize that entanglement entropy really is a function not of a segment in a Cauchy slice, but of a diamond in spacetime, meaning the domain of dependence of a Cauchy slice. So first step is this. First, express S as a function of a diamond D, rather than as a segment within a Cauchy slice. The second step is provide a cutoff, that is Lorentz invariant, if possible. So let me explain the idea. Formally speaking, you can show that entanglement entropy at the formal level between A and B is a half of the mutual information between A and its complement. This is as formal a formula as this one, because it's also infinite, but it provides us with a hint as to how to improve this formula and give a cutoff. OK, so if I consider this diamond here, D, yeah. I'm assuming for the sake of the discussion a pure state, for the global state, yes. The picture I have in mind is a pure state that is just obtained by evolving the Minkowski vacuum in flat space into something else through gravitational collapse. OK. So let's consider this diamond a little bit more carefully. Here is a diamond D, characterized as the domain of dependence of everything that's inside two points. And understand that entanglement entropy I can think of as mutual information between the domain and the complement of the domain. The reason why entanglement entropy is divergent is because the domain and the complement of the domain touch each other at the two boundary corners. So let me introduce a smearing of D that I shall call D plus, that is just a little bit larger than D in a sense that I'll explain just now. Then the expression one half of the mutual information between D and the complement of D plus now is a finite quantity because these two diamonds, they don't touch each other. How am I going to choose D plus in order to obtain something that is well defined? Well, I'll introduce a criterion, which is that the two little diamonds that sit in between the corners of D and the corners of D plus have a fixed constant proper volume, mu. So let me declare that mu is the spacetime volume of this set delta in spacetime consisting of two subsets, delta 1 and delta 2, those two diamonds here that sit between D and D plus. So let mu be the spacetime volume of these two guys. This is something that is clearly a geometric notion. It's not depending on the choice of coordinates in spacetime. So in that sense, it is Lorentz invariant. And it provides a meaningful notion of a cutoff that I can use to regularize the entanglement entropy. So whenever I talk about the entanglement entropy of D, let's say that what I really mean is a half the mutual information between D and D plus complement, where D plus is chosen in such a way that the volume between D and D plus is a fixed mu. So that defines a mu-dependent notion of entanglement entropy, but now the cutoff is a space-time volume rather than a length scale. No. No, it doesn't. Yeah. So as mu is small, then you get a well-defined formula, as I'll show now. So I'll get a well-defined formula in a limit where mu goes to zero. For now, I'm just introducing one smearing d plus mu, such that the volume of the difference is mu. It's not unique. Yep. D.
D, okay, so D is what you want. And
yeah.
Then D plus is defined
as a smearing of D.
Any old region you want with this constraint on U.
Yep. And then I'll look at small mu's and see what I get as a formula for the entanglement entropy of D. Okay.
Yep. Is D arbitrary or is it the
boundaries are null by definition. This is the causal domain of dependence of any space-like surface within D, and so that defines a null, a set with null boundaries. Okay, in 3+1 dimensions, the causal domain of a Cauchy slice is a complicated object, but in 2 dimensions, it's easy. It looks like a diamond. It is a diamond. Okay. So at the end of the day, clearly this quantity here will be a function of 2 points, the 2 corners that define D. End of mu. Okay? That's right. And as mu is small, we'll get a dominant contribution. Okay? Let's see that. S mu of D, like I said, is a half the mutual information between D and D mu plus complement. And that, by definition, is a half of the entanglement entropy of D, whatever that is supposed to be, and I'll explain the trick that I'm playing now. The formula for the mutual information of two sets can be written this way in terms of entanglement entropy, and vice versa, entanglement entropy can be written in terms of mutual information in that way. So this looks like a circular argument where I'm expressing mutual information in terms of entanglement entropy and vice versa. But the point is, the whole thing is really a trick to improve on that formula, okay? And that formula is an epsilon-dependent formula, which is no good. So if I stick in the epsilon-dependent formula in this expression here, we'll see that the epsilons cancel, and what remains is a quantity that only depends on mu. So it's not a first principle derivation of entanglement entropy. It's a way to start from an ill-defined notion of entanglement entropy, introduce the notion of a proper space-time cutoff mu, and get a formula that only depends on mu. Okay? So the first. S epsilon. Delta is green. Is the green thing here. Yeah. Yes, exactly. But because the entanglement entropy between. No. This is D plus mu complement. Okay. But by symmetry of the entanglement entropy between the two subsystems, S of D plus mu is the same as complement, is the same as S of D plus mu. Okay, so I have a formula that involves D, D plus, and delta, this small region in between. Okay? this quantity here, I should be quick about this because this is not the main point of my talk. So this quantity here will involve the log of delta u squared delta v squared for d over epsilon squared, epsilon 4. This one will involve the log of delta u squared delta v squared for d plus mu over epsilon 4. And this quantity here, if these two diamonds are sufficiently small, is additive and has two terms in it, the entanglement entropy of delta 1 and the entanglement entropy of delta 2. And so the third term here is log of delta u squared delta v squared for delta 1 over epsilon 4. And it has another term, delta u squared delta v squared for delta 2 over epsilon 4. Do I assume a compact space? Yeah, so this is delta u. This here is delta v. And little delta u for delta 1 is this one. Little delta v for delta 1 is this one. And same here. For the complement. By symmetry of entanglement entropy between A and B. Yeah? OK. If you combine these four terms, you arrive at a formula for S mu of D, where the epsilons have canceled. And now what you have is C over 12 when mu is small, log of delta u squared, delta v squared, over delta u 1 squared, delta v 1 squared. There will be 4 here. And the same for the second one. Just combining all those terms. And then there's just one last step, and I'm finished with this section, which is a little awkward, I realize, but I just need to be quick so I can get to the rest. In a two-dimensional spacetime, the spacetime metric can be written as minus a conformals factor squared in terms of two null coordinates u and v, du dv. OK. Those two coordinates are the ones that are chosen to define the state, the conformal vacuum that I'm in. And if that's the case, then I should realize that this here the spacetime volume mu of delta 1, mu 1, that is nothing but omega squared omega minus 2 evaluated at the point 1. Times delta u1 delta v1. Not sure about the plus or the minus here. You're sorry?
Yeah, I can't read that. As the denominator is presumably just the product of the value of the two that are delta.
It's the product of these guys here. Yep. OK. So, these two guys here, they conspire to give just the spacetime volume of delta 1 and delta 2. And so one ends up with a formula which is C over 12 log of delta u 4 delta v 4 omega 1 squared omega 2 squared over mu squared. And this is S mu of D. Omega 1 is the conformal factor in these coordinates evaluated at here. And if mu is sufficiently small, this gives me one value, omega 1. Similarly, omega 2 is the conformal factor evaluated in this domain here, which, if it's small, gives me one value. And that goes into the formula for the entanglement entropy. The main point of this conversation is to say, is to see that starting from the Holtze, Larsen, Wilczek formula that involved an ill-defined non-Lorentz invariant cutoff, there is a way to understand it in terms of a Lorentz covariant spacetime cutoff and the metric. And that's my point. That's the point I want to make, and I want to move on if that's okay. Yeah. Quickly. Yeah, the power has changed. That's because I made a mistake. And so maybe it's 24, maybe. I'm not sure what this is here. Maybe 12, maybe 24. Yeah, yeah, but. Ah, okay. Yep, and maybe a 12 here. I'm sorry about that. All the details are in the paper. I was just too rushed. I was just too rushed. Very good.
So this regularization is, the fact that there's omega here.
Okay. Okay, so intuitively, this epsilon here is a length, so it should know about the metric. So the entanglement entropy should not just be a conformally invariant quantity. It should depend on the metric, actually, because of this cutoff here. And the way it does is in terms of the conformal factor of the metric at the two corners of the diamond. This is the point. If we have this, then we can move on to black hole physics. This was the first section of the talk. Okay. Okay, I'll finish this one and I'll raise. Yeah. Yeah, so if the right, but. Yeah.
That's called a gravitational anomaly.
Yeah.
They're not equal in conformal field theory. And
yeah.
I don't really understand why there should be such an infinite link that seems important.
Not for now.
They're not equal. The problem is then a change in delta U and a change in delta P. This formula is a combination of two terms, one with the two different central charges. So they're not equal. They only combine into one thing.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So this was preparation to just understand the way the metric goes into the entanglement entropy, and this allows me to. To apply this formula to causal domains D of interest in a black hole spacetime. And one such causal domain of interest, where this is against chi plus, this is against chi minus, and this is again I naught, would be the causal domain for 2 points, like this, that are very far from the black hole. If they are very far from the black hole, I can apply this formula and get something that will depend on omega 1 and omega 2. And as I take omega 2 to, as I take this point to I naught, if I assume that omega squared goes to 1 near I naught, which is to say that around this point and actually in the past, spacetime was flat, then I get a formula that simplifies greatly. In this limit, I'm just considering really the end. Spacetime is flat over there. Ds squared is minus du dv.
So you're not dead omega. I think there's a confusion.
Yeah, so this is the physical metric, not the extension of the metric that one uses to compactify. And in the physical metric, the neighborhood of I naught is a flat patch of spacetime where omega is 1. Okay. So as I consider this limit here, I get a quantity that depends on a degenerate diamond, if you wish, which is really the segment at I plus between I naught and some retarded time u. And so by this procedure, you arrive at a formula for s of that u here, which involves c over 12 logarithm of omega squared at this u plus something which is of the order of log mu. And so it's a constant. And it's a spacetime constant. It's spacetime volume constant that I can forget about if I'm interested in the dynamics of this quantity as a function of u. OK, so by this token, what I've just defined for you is the entanglement entropy of a field across a boundary s squared plus between times before u and times after u. This quantity measures quantum correlations about u. And define a curve as a function of time, which we can investigate. And investigating this curve is really investigating what is called the page curve, I believe, in the black hole literature. So this is the formula. This is a workable formula for the page curve in two dimensions. And so the, yep. We are in a space that is conformally flat. I mean what I just said is a spacetime that is that does not have a horizon. It has the conformal structure of Minkowski space, but it can have some non-trivial geometry. I have not told you yet how I would apply this to black hole physics. I just wanted to say, if that's the spacetime, this is a formula for the page curve. OK? And it doesn't have to be trivial. So it is the space, physically, it's the space, it's the state that you get if you start from the Minkowski vacuum and then couple it to some bulk metric by minimal coupling.
No, it does.
I'm just trying to walk step by step. Yes. No, but there can be non-trivial structure. I just mean to say that at the moment I'm talking about the same spacetime as conformally flat. Say I get an expression for a page curve that's not necessarily trivial because spacetime is not necessarily flat, and so the field couples to that background. And then the next step, of course, is to realize that the same thing can be applied if actually spacetime does not have the conformal structure of Minkowski space, but corresponds to maybe this spacetime here, which would be obtained in classical GR given gravitational collapse, or other spacetimes of interest, such as this one, which was considered by Hawking as a model of evaporation where a horizon would form and hide a singularity, but that singularity would eventually disappear because a bunch of radiation would have come out and taken all the mass of the spacetime. Those are different spacetimes where I can still apply this formula along that bit of squi plus here as a function of u. Okay? And I can study this formula. Okay. Yep. Yeah. Yes. So the assumption is, I'll try and answer this question. Okay. In a conformal field theory, you can think of a conformal vacuum state as being defined by initial conditions. Okay. Initial conditions I can declare to be this state, which is the vacuum with respect to locally inertial coordinates to a locally inertial frame in the past. Okay, so in the past there, a point has two null coordinates v and w. And I consider the state that is the vacuum with respect to v and w, where v for this point is advanced time for that point, and w is the wave that has bounced off the center before any non-trivial geometry has arisen. In the past, v and w define two null coordinates in a neighborhood of squi minus, which are really just ingoing and outgoing waves in flat space. And I can consider the state that's the vacuum with respect to those ingoing modes and outgoing modes in the past. Okay? Then the entanglement entropy is a function of that state. And that state can be thought of as inducing a mapping between squi minus and squi plus if I just continue this to the future. Squi plus is equipped with retarded time u and a fine parameter on squi plus. And there is a mapping induced by propagation of the field in that spacetime relating w and u. Okay? Geometrical optics, the ray tracing mapping. Yeah. Okay. Just by tracing that ray from squi minus all the way to r equals naught and then to the future. Then you can show, and it's easy to see that omega squared of u given these coordinates, okay, is given by 1 over dw over du. Okay. Shall we accept this or should I explain? Okay. So this is the ray tracing mapping. W of u is the ray tracing mapping, the one that relates, given the geometry in the bulk, w at squi minus to u at squi plus. Okay. And so the conformal factor here is just given by 1 over the derivative of this map that I can denote 1 over w dot, so that the entanglement entropy s of u is really minus c over 12 log of w dot of u. And this is an interesting presentation of the entanglement entropy at squi plus of the pH curve in terms of a function, the ray tracing function in those space times, which is very familiar to anybody who has studied moving mirror problems and also the Hawking effect. Because in Hawking's paper, this ray tracing mapping is really what determines the Hawking effect. Okay. I'll just move on, given this. The point of this section was to explain, yeah. Oh, sorry. Okay. I wanted to give you examples of the page curve in those various space times, but I'll skip that because there's little time left. So I'm now moving to the second section where I'll talk about the relationship between this entanglement entropy, the page curve at scribe plus, and the energy flux that's coming out from that particular space time. There's a formula in quantum field theory in curved spacetimes that gives you the outgoing flux in that particular state that was the vacuum in the past, and that has now been evolved by coupling minimally to the metric as a function of this ray tracing mapping W. Turns out that this here is given by minus C over 24 pi times the so-called Schwarzian derivative of W, and that is the third derivative of W over the first minus 3/2 w dot squared, w double dot squared over w dot squared. This is a formula by Fulling, Davies, and also Unruh from the 70s, 74. So if I just take this formula as input, as giving me the outgoing energy flux here, TUU, given the ray tracing mapping, and if I compare it with the entanglement entropy at scribe plus given the ray tracing mapping, I find that they are both functions of the same ray tracing mapping. And in fact, simple manipulations allow you to see that this quantity here, which let me call F for flux, for energy flux, F of U turns out to be given by 1 over 24 pi times 6 s dot squared over c of u plus s double dot of u. So this formula is by itself an interesting result because it relates in full generality given these spacetimes the energy flux and the page curve. Okay? If you know entanglement entropy as a function of u and its derivatives, then you actually do know how much energy is coming out of spacetime. Vice versa, if you look at this equation as a differential equation for S, you'll see quickly that S is completely determined by F and some initial conditions, so that there is a complete equivalence between the knowledge of the page curve and the knowledge of the mass law or flux curve. One determines the other and vice versa. Okay. So this I take as an interesting result per se. Notice in particular that this formula involves not just first derivatives of S, but also second derivatives, and it's valid at any U. So it's not a formula that relates energy and entropy in adiabatic settings or slowly changing spacetimes. It's valid always, and it has this second term with respect to what you would expect in a du equal tds kind of law. It has the second derivative, and that second derivative is what allows you to capture not just adiabatic transformations in the bulk, but also non-adiabatic ones, fast transformations of spacetime. In the sense that if you consider this formula here for the entanglement entropy, you'll see that S dot is proportional to minus W double dot over W dot, okay? And that quantity here is the same as the so-called peeling function of Hawking radiation theory, which in the early stages of the Hawking evaporation is the surface gravity of the black hole. Okay, so what you see then, and the surface gravity, I recall, is related to the Hawking temperature by Hawking temperature is kappa over 2 pi, and kappa, the surface gravity, is 1 over 4m for a spacetime describing an incipient black hole of mass m. So F, you can think of as dE by dt, by du. and then a number alpha, and then something which is kappa, and that's the Hawking temperature, and then S dot, another one which is S dot, which is you can think of as ds over du. So it's in that sense that the first part of this formula here is in the spirit of dE equals TdS. But my point was, first of all, it's valid also when kappa is not constant, so that this is not really a temperature. And second of all, there is a second term in that formula that's clearly involving higher order derivatives. And so it's in that sense that it's non-adiabatic. Did I answer your question? OK. Now the next step. The next step is to realize that this equation here, as an equation for S given F, can be rewritten by a change of variables. And it's very insightful to make this change of variables. If you introduce psi of u, so that psi of u is exponential 6s of u over the central charge, you just define this quantity here. And you define v of u to be 12 pi over c times the flux f of u. Then this equation here becomes minus psi double dot of u plus v of u psi of u equals 0. It is exactly the same equation here as there, only written in different variables. But now clearly this equation can be interpreted as the Schrödinger equation for a zero energy state. And this provides a very helpful intuition in understanding the dynamics of the Page curve. Now you just think of the exponential of the entropy as a wave function, the flux as a potential, and you understand that the way the entanglement entropy is related to the flux is the same as the way the wave function of a particle is related to the potential in a potential well. So this provides intuition. And there's a couple of examples you can look at, which I'm not going to tell you because of lack of time. But it also provides something else. If you integrate this equation in U, you'll find a boundary term involving psi dot and the integral of this quantity here. So if you assume that the Page curve S, whatever it does, and in practice what it does is it starts from 0, it grows linearly for some time, then something mysterious happens, and then it reaches a value which is likely to be 0. So if S dot of minus infinity is 0, and if S dot of plus infinity is 0, which are conditions for the eventual purification of radiation in the evaporation process, okay? So if unitarity holds and implies that there is no entanglement entropy production in the very far past and no entanglement entropy production in the very far future, if that's the case, hence the same holds for phi dot, then by integrating this quantity in du, what you get is integral du psi of u v of u is 0. But reinstating entanglement entropy in the place of psi and flux in the place of the potential, this is an identity that says, maybe I should lift the blackboard. That the integral in du of the flux times the exponential of 6 times the entropy divided by c should be 0 under these unitarity conditions. And here is my first proposition in this talk. For this to be true, given that this exponential here is a strictly non-negative function, actually a strictly positive function, f should at some point change sign and become negative. OK? So from this, you see that there exists an interval of u's, u1, u2, such that f of u is a negative number for u in this interval. And if I may recall, f of u is the outgoing energy flux from this black hole. So a negative outgoing energy flux means that for a transient period of time, but a necessary one, the mass of the black hole actually increases. The outgoing energy flux being negative means that the mass of the black hole increases. And so this is what Eugenio and I called the last gasp of a black hole. It is a necessary condition given that we assume that entanglement entropy at the end of the day is not produced and at the beginning of times is not produced anymore. Then it is a necessary condition that the outgoing energy flux becomes negative. Yes, Lee? It is a weaker condition than saying, to say that all the information has been restored is to say that S is eventually zero and constant at zero. A weaker condition is that S dot is zero. So it could actually reach a different value. Yes, and I'm not assuming that that's the case. Yeah, but that's just because I don't want to talk about what would happen in this case. I'm sorry, it's just limited time. Yeah, yeah, I know. But I just want to make this point, this one point here. If information is being purified fully, in particular, then there will be a gasp for the black hole. More weakly, if you only assume that no information is being exchanged eventually, then you also get, by the very same equation relating entanglement entropy and flux, that there will be a last gasp for the black hole. Yes, you can within this framework where you assume that it's a good approximation for the dynamics of an evaporating black hole to consider a two-dimensional CFT in the time radius plane. In that framework, yes. So, okay, maybe I can help with this discussion quickly by telling you what would happen in this case here. This is the case considered by Hawking where an event horizon forms and then hides a singularity. So some information apparently looks like it's lost in there. Everything that went into the singularity seems to be lost as far as Scribe Plus is concerned. So what would you get for S and F in that case? So the answer is this one. I'll just make a little bit of space to explain this. I'm not talking about baby universes. I'm just saying whatever goes on here, if this is the structure of space-time, then the following will happen for S of u and F of u. I don't know what that is. Is this a singularity? Is this a baby universe? I don't know. Yes, yes, it's consistent. Given that, so this may continue into something unknown. I don't know. All I need to know is what happens as far as the exterior is concerned at Scribe Plus. Okay, so when that is the case, you find something which is quite interesting. Let me first tell you about the flux as a function of u. So the flux as a function of u is given by minus 1 over, minus a constant alpha over m squared of u in the Hawking formula. So this is the Hawking mass loss rate. The flux is positive, so it's an always positive number. It does not satisfy this condition here. Instead, what it does is it starts from 0 at early times before collapse, then goes to an approximately constant value that is proportional to the Hawking temperature squared for some time. And then eventually, the mass of the black hole decreases enough so that the flux goes up. It goes up, it goes up. And in finite time, it diverges. That's the flux. A time that scales like the cube of the mass of the black hole. That's the evaporation time. So that is what happens for the flux. This is clearly a case where the flux does not become negative ever. So is this consistent with entanglement entropy going back to a constant value? No, it's not. And so what is the case instead? So let me call this u final, uf. This is this u final here. If I wanted to apply the theorem there, but that's not the case. I can compute it in that space-time. And so what I find is something different. Entanglement entropy starts at 0 before anything happens, then grows linearly for most of the lifetime of the black hole. And then what happens when u becomes uf, this point here? OK? What happens is that the entanglement entropy diverges in finite time there. Hawking did that. I'm just showing the counterpart of that in terms of the flux, of the entanglement entropy. So this is the formula that you derive in a semi-classical adiabatic approximation, where you start from a Schwarzschild GAB. Okay, you assume that. That gives you a vacuum TAB. And that vacuum TAB gives you F equals 1 over alpha over the square mass of the Schwarzschild. And you just say, well, by energy conservation, let me equate this to minus m dot. OK? And by this, you get a spacetime that has a dynamically evolving mass. That mass reduces. It shrinks. In finite time, it will go to 0. This is the Hawking evaporation time. This is uf. OK?
So that's enough to give you the curve at the top.
Yeah. And
okay, not, if you believe in the curve at the top,
you should believe in this. Yeah, yeah. I'm saying this is a case where this clearly does not apply. Why does it not apply? Because s dot never goes to 0. What you find instead by an explicit computation is this and this, an entanglement singularity in finite time.
But you use the formula.
No.
The double dot formula. No, not that one. You use the S. What formula did you use to get?
This one. I did the ray tracing in that space time. It would give the same thing.
You did use
that. Either way, either directly. Either way, either I just compute the ray tracing mapping in that space-time by tracing rays, by solving the geodesic equation, get W of u, and get this. Or I compare this with the flux that I got by this different method, assuming energy conservation, and I get the same thing. It's consistent. What is not the case in these cases, in this particular space-time, is that the assumption that s dot goes to 0 eventually applies. It does not apply. So the conclusion here does not apply. And indeed, something else, something very weird happens. And that's that the entanglement entropy diverges in finite time. So I believe what you should think is that if this spacetime is supposed to be the one that happens, what you would have is a naked null entanglement singularity along this light ray here. And you should probably. Yep. Yeah.
The graph is diverging.
Yeah.
Something happened in the neighborhood of the wiggly line, which sets off
the yeah. Probably, but we don't know. So within semi-classical gravity, this is the prediction. And just like if you make this assumption here, just like classical GR, you should stop believing in when you get singularities. Similarly, semi-classical GR, you should stop believing in when you get singularities. So this is a case where clearly this picture is not consistent with the semi-classical framework. It's not the case that the Hawking picture where the black hole eventually evaporates and nothing remains is consistent with semi-classical gravity. It is not, because you get this entanglement singularity.
So what if you adjust that formula for F by hand to make it do what you want to do, then what's going to happen to F?
Let me tell you now. Inconsistency. I'm saying the answer is inconsistency.
You've been working with a particular regularization of entropy which doesn't apply in this case.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Are you, among other things, claiming that you can't make sense of that original logic?
So to speak, yes. That's what I'm weakly trying to say. I'm trying to say not in a too strong way, but that's what I'm trying to say. But that's okay, because I'd like to consider another scenario. There's another scenario. This is not the only scenario. There's another scenario where the conformal of structure of spacetime is that of Minkowski space, actually. No event horizon actually forms. Information is eventually released. And so spacetime really has this structure here with a trapped region in the bulk that evaporates. Maybe. It is another scenario.
But is that you're going to answer my question about what happens to F if you fix it up the way you like it?
Yeah.
So what happens? Is that what that one is?
So this is one way of fixing F, by removing the singularity and the event horizon in some way. Yes. This is the Hayward proposal. So for the Hayward proposal, you get a flux that actually does become negative at some point. So the flux as a function of u starts at 0, goes like this, and then becomes widely negative for some time, and then 0. This is something that looks like it could be the purifying burst at the end of everything. And indeed, if you look at the corresponding page curve, the S of u curve, what it looks like is 0, then linear growth in the Hawking phase, and then eventually, beam. This happens. So in this spacetime, entanglement entropy not only goes back to 0, but it overshoots dramatically, becomes widely negative, and then goes to 0. And you can understand that. You can understand that because if you remember, entanglement entropy production was proportional to kappa, and kappa is minus W double dot over W dot, that's the Peeling function. And if you think of the geodesics that are outgoing from this space-time, so roughly speaking, TR, outgoing geodesics, when outgoing geodesics are peeled in the sense that they move away from one another, you get a positive kappa. But when they are, on the other hand, squeezed by the background metric, you get a negative kappa. So this is squeezed geodesics. If you look at what happens to the Hayward metric here, you'll find that all the geodesics that were ingoing and then outgoing accumulate near the inner horizon. So there's a bunch of them accumulating. And so when they are released into free space, they are released in a very, very squeezed way. Okay? And a squeezed way is a negative kappa, and a negative kappa is a decreasing S. And because that squeezing is exponential, you get this great overshoot of S as a function of U.
Okay,
You can, two ways to answer this question. Either you just plug in the metric into a computer and get it numerically, and then I can't tell you, or you make an onsatz for this metric, a simple onsatz, and then you can answer. And so that onsatz would be to take a slab of non-flat space, flat space at the beginning, flat space at the end, then Schwarzschild here with the outer horizon, and something like the sitter in the ball, in the core, and some kind of a matching condition in between, maybe a space-like matching condition like this. So here you would have the sitter space. Here you would have Schwarzschild space. Here an outer horizon, and here an inner horizon. And you just fix this and compute the page curve in that case. You can do that analytically. We did it. And you get that this guy here is exponential in the ratio between delta v, the lifetime of the hole, and the Hubble factor in the de Sitter core. So it's exponentially spiky in that sense.
Is it a finite lower bound?
Finite lower bound. Yes, yes, I'll do that. No. Not an entanglement entropy. The entanglement. Yeah. And we're talking about entanglement entropy in the late stages of a black hole evaporating. And the physics of entanglement entropy for massless fields is that it grows when outgoing geodesics are peeled, as in the beginning of the process, but it decreases when they are squeezed. And so in this particular.
I mean, the question I understand is that, yep. The thing is that when it decreases, then it has nothing to do with an entropy. In the sense that, you know, it doesn't satisfy the second law. That's what I'm saying. Because, you know, then you cannot.
This is not so classical thermodynamics. This is vacuum entanglement entropy.
Yeah, but therefore it loses its meaning as an entropy.
Its superficial meaning as an entropy in the sense of classical thermodynamics, I would say. Yeah.
Keeps
the name. It's the von Neumann entropy of a reduced density matrix.
Well, it's the entropy insofar as the same formula.
Yeah, yeah.
The same formula, but it doesn't satisfy, it doesn't grow.
Okay, so you can compute the page curve in that case explicitly just to get an understanding of it. The first thing you notice, it doesn't look like a page curve, it overshoots. The second thing you see is that the purification is very, very burst-like, it's spiky. And so what I wanted to tell you in the last section, I'm sorry I'm so late, was that this is impossible by energy conservation, in fact. So the Hayward metric is ruled out. It's ruled out because I can prove a theorem for you that purification, no matter what it looks like, has to be slow in a sense that I can make quantitative to anybody who's interested. But being so fast, it costs too much energy to do that squeezing here in the vacuum, more energy than there is in the ADM mass of the black hole in the first place. And so this is not an actually plausible scenario. It looks appealing. This Hayward metric, it looks like it's going to purify. Indeed, it purifies, but it purifies at too high a cost in terms of energy. So I don't know what and I'll wrap up with this sentence here. I don't know what a bulk metric is plausible for a semi-classical space-time describing the complete history of a black hole evaporating, and I'm looking for one. But what I can tell you is it will have to involve very slow purification. Maybe as slow as the evaporation itself. Maybe a more likely picture is that of Page, where entanglement entropy grows, then turns around, and then decreases in the same time, more or less, almost symmetrically. I don't know. This is just a scenario. In that scenario, if that is the case, the turnaround is the negative energy moment, the time when F is negative. So at the turnaround, at the Page time, in that scenario, the mass of the black holes would have to grow. And that's where I'm closing, and I'm really sorry that I'm so late.
That was sort of my last question. What if you just make gas do what we like it to do? Can you infer back what has to be the case for the space time? Is there any way of reading?
ongoing project with Tommaso, my student here. Lee?
Yeah, but again, you contradict, if you follow the page scenario, you contradict semi-classical physics, because the page time is the time when the black hole is still large, and there's no mechanism for the energy flux to turn negative. So I think you're on the process to proving that final effects have, that the unitary has to be violating, has to be really good.
Maybe. Not sure yet. I'm not committed to the answer yet. I'm in that process.
Thank you. Glad you get there.
This is recorded. Watch out.
I'll come in with that.
Yes, please.
So you said this spike is a contradiction because it happens too fast, but isn't it just a contradiction by being a negative entropy?
No, because the zero here is the Minkowski value. Entanglement entropy can be higher than in the Minkowski vacuum, because there's just more correlation in the state, or less. And so negative, as in this curve, only means less correlated than in the Minkowski vacuum.
Yeah, but how low can it go? I mean, it can't go infinitely low.
That's my question. How do you set the bound?
I don't know what the lower bound is. In a given space, given a space time, I get the bound.
No, but
I get how low it. No,
no,
no, no, no, no. So
comparing it to Minkowski, yeah, but you put a cutoff. So if you're comparing it to the.
This S
below,
is my S mu for that particular diamond at Sky Plus minus S mu for a similar diamond at Sky Plus in Minkowski.
Okay, but that's some constant, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you shouldn't be able to go below minus that constant.
Why shouldn't I?
Because the first one can never be negative.
I'm sorry, I don't get it. So there's this ultraviolet divergent quantity, which is the entanglement entropy in a given diamond. And there's entanglement entropy in a diamond in the Minkowski vacuum. And I can compare them. And one can be larger than the other.
That's right.
So this one.
But both of them can only be positive.
Yes, but what I'm plotting here is the difference.
I know, but the second one, you should be able to, once you know mu, you should know what it is. And so that sets a lower bound on how negative your graph can go. No?
I'm sorry, I'm not getting it.
The one is positive. You just write that the second one is positive.
This can be arbitrarily smaller than this one.
Small. Doesn't matter.
But it's 10 degrees greater than zero.
No, minus. Sorry, I don't get
the
it.
The first term should be greater than zero or not?
No.
Why not?
This is this very, very large term, the ultraviolet divergent one.
Can it go below zero?
This is minus infinity, so to speak. So there's a finite part.
Only if the limit, only if you send mu to zero.
The mu's cancel here. It's the same mu in both spacetimes. The mu's cancel. Okay? And so this is C over 12 log of omega squared at my point u in the spacetime of interest. This can be larger than 1 or smaller than 1.
If you have an idea that there's a genuine cutoff, say, at the Planck line, then I don't see why both terms, even though most they might have a divergent contribution, it seems like they're both positive.
You
have a difference of two positive terms. So therefore, the left-hand side can be no greater than the negative.
I'm not sure. I mean, not within this framework. In this framework, maybe this framework needs to be changed to accommodate for a space-time discreteness of some sort. But the way this framework is set here, at the semi-classical level, sort of macroscopic, there is no lower bound on S. This omega here.
Yeah, this guy is picking positive. So for a given space time, that's what he's saying. There's a lower bound.
This is not strictly positive.
Omega squared. Otherwise, the metric is.
Yeah, yeah, but log of zero is minus infinity.
Yeah, but that gives you a bound.
I'm sorry, I'm not.
But
the mu in this setting here, mu just cancels. It is a.
No, gives you if z at s is smaller than c, where c is a new dependent constant.
Yeah, but
indeed c mu goes to infinity.
Yeah.
Mu goes to zero.
Yes. Thank you, Astrid, for your patience.